breath from her mouth that I feel against my ear. As she gasps, I sweep kick her legs out from under her, and she falls hard on the ground, sending dust into the air. I pull my foot back and kick as hard as I can at her ribs. My mother and father would not approve of my kicking someone when she's down. I don't care. She curls into a ball to protect her side, and I kick again, this time hitting her in the stomach. Like a child. I kick again, this time hitting her in the face. Blood springs from her nose and spreads over her face. Look at her. Another kick hits her in the chest. I pull my foot back again, but Four's hands clamp around my arms, and he pulls me away from her with irresistible force. I breathe through gritted teeth, staring at Molly's blood-covered face, the color deep and rich and beautiful, in a way. She groans, and I hear a gurgling in her throat, watch blood trickle from her lips. You won, Four mutters. Stop. I wipe the sweat from my forehead. He stares at me. His eyes are too wide. They look alarmed. I think you should leave, he says. Take a walk. I'm fine, I say. I'm fine now, I say again, this time for myself. I wish I could say I felt guilty for what I did. I don't. Chapter 15. Visiting day. The second I open my eyes, I remember. My heart leaps and then plummets when I see Molly hobble across the dormitory, her nose purple between strips of medical tape. Once I see her leave, I check for Peter and Drew. Neither of them is in the dormitory, so I change quickly. As long as they aren't here, I don't care who sees me in my underwear. Not anymore. Everyone else dresses in silence. Not even Christina smiles. We all know that we might go to the pit floor and search every face, and never find one that belongs to us. I make my bed with tight corners, like my father taught me. As I pinch a stray hair from my pillow, Eric walks in. Attention, he announces, flicking a lock of dark hair from his eyes. I want to give you some advice about today. If by some miracle your families do come to visit you, he scans our faces and smirks, which I doubt, it is best not to seem too attached. That will make it easier for you and easier for them. We also take the phrase faction before blood very seriously here. Attachment to your family suggests you aren't entirely pleased with your faction, which would be shameful. Understand? I understand. I hear the threat in Eric's sharp voice. The only part of that speech that Eric meant was the last part. We are dauntless, and we need to act accordingly. On my way out of the dormitory, Eric stops me. I may have underestimated you, Stiff, he says. You did well yesterday. I stare up at him. For the first time since I beat Molly, guilt pinches my gut. If Eric thinks I did something right, I must have done it wrong. Thank you, I say. I slip out of the dormitory. Once my eyes adjust to the dim hallway light, I see Christina and Will ahead of me, Will laughing probably at a joke Christina made. I don't try to catch up. For some reason, I feel it would be a mistake to interrupt them. Al is missing. I didn't see him in the dormitory, and he's not walking toward the pit now. Maybe he's already there. I run my fingers through my hair and smooth it into a bun. I check my clothes. Am I covered up? My pants are tight, and my collarbone is showing. They won't approve. Who cares if they approve? I set my jaw. This is my faction now. These are the clothes my faction wears. I stop just before the hallway ends. Clusters of families stand on the pit floor. Most of them dauntless families, with dauntless initiates. They still look strange to me. A mother with a pierced eyebrow, a father with a tattooed arm, an initiate with purple hair. A wholesome family unit. I spot Drew and Molly standing alone at one end of the room and suppress a smile. At least their families didn't come. But Peter's did. He stands next to a tall man with bushy eyebrows and a short, meek-looking woman with red hair. Neither of his parents looks like him. They both wear black pants and white shirts. Typical candor outfits. and his father speaks so loudly I can almost hear him from where I stand. Do they know what kind of person their son is? Then again, what kind of person am I? Across the room, Will stands with a woman in a blue dress. She doesn't look old enough to be his mother, but she has the same crease between her eyebrows as he does, and the same golden hair. He talked about having a sister once. Maybe that's her. Next to him, Christina hugs a dark-skinned woman in Candor black and white. Standing behind Christina is a young girl, also a Candor, her younger sister. Should I even bother scanning the crowd for my parents? I could turn around and go back to the dormitory. Then I see her. My mother stands alone near the railing with her hands clasped in front of her. She has never looked more out of place, with her gray slacks and gray jacket buttoned at the throat, her hair in its simple twist, and her face placid. I start toward her, tears jumping into my eyes. She came. She came for me. I walk faster. She sees me, and for a second her expression is blank, like she doesn't know who I am. Then her eyes light up, and she opens her arms. She smells like soap and laundry detergent. "Beatrice," she whispers. She runs her hand over my hair. "Don't cry," I tell myself. I hold her until I can blink the moisture from my eyes, and then pull back to look at her again. I smile with closed lips, just like she does. She touches my cheek. "Well, look at you," she says. "You filled out." She puts her arm across my shoulders. "Tell me how you are."
"You first."
The old habits are back. I should let her speak first. I shouldn't let the conversation stay focused on me for too long. I should make sure she doesn't need anything.
"Today is a special occasion," she says. "I came to see you. So let's talk mostly about you. It is my gift to you. My selfless mother. She should not be giving me gifts. Not after I left her and my father."
I walk with her toward the railing that overlooks the chasm, glad to be close to her. The last week and a half has been more affectionless than I realized. At home we did not touch each other often, and the most I ever saw my parents do was hold hands at the dinner table. But it was more than this. More than here.
"Just one question." I feel my pulse in my throat. "Where's Dad? Is he visiting Caleb?"
"Ah," she shakes her head. "Your father had to be at work." I look down.
"You can tell me if he didn't want to come." Her eyes travel over my face. "Your father has been selfish lately. That doesn't mean he doesn't love you. I promise."
I stare at her, stunned.
My father? Selfish?
More startling than the label is the fact that she assigned it to him. I can't tell by looking at her if she's angry. I don't expect to be able to, but she must be. If she calls him selfish, she must be angry.
"What about Caleb?" I say. "Will you visit him later?"
"I wish I could," she says. "But the erudite have prohibited abnegation visitors from entering their compound. If I tried, I would be removed from the premises."
"What?" I demand. "That's terrible. Why would they do that?"
"Tensions between our factions are higher than ever," she says. "I wish it wasn't that way, but there's little I can do about it." I think of Caleb, standing among the erudite initiates, scanning the crowd for our mother, and feel a pang in my stomach. Part of me is still angry with him for keeping so many secrets from me. But I don't want him to hurt.
"That's terrible," I repeat.
I look toward the chasm. Standing alone at the railing is Four. Though he's not an initiate anymore, most of the Dauntless use this day to come together with their families. Either his family doesn't like to come together, or he wasn't originally Dauntless.
Which faction could he have come from?
"There's one of my instructors," I lean closer to her and say. "He's kind of intimidating."
"He's handsome," she says.
I find myself nodding without thinking. She laughs and lifts her arm from my shoulders. I want to steer her away from him,
But just as I'm about to suggest that we go somewhere else, he looks over his shoulder. His eyes widen at the sight of my mother. She offers him her hand.
Hello. My name is Natalie, she says. I'm Beatrice's mother.
I have never seen my mother shake hands with someone. Four eases his hand into hers, looking stiff, and shakes it twice. The gesture looks unnatural for both of them.
No. Four was not originally dauntless if he doesn't shake hands easily.
Four, he says. It's nice to meet you.
Four, my mother repeats, smiling.
Is that a nickname?
Yes. He doesn't elaborate.
What is his real name?
Your daughter is doing well here. I've been overseeing her training.
Since when does overseeing include throwing knives at me and scolding me at every opportunity?
That's good to hear, she says. I know a few things about Dauntless Initiation, and I was worried about her.
He looks at me, and his eyes move down my face, from nose to mouth to chin. Then he says, "You shouldn't worry."
I can't keep the heat from rushing into my cheeks. I hope it isn't noticeable.
Is he just reassuring her because she's my mother, or does he really believe that I am capable?
And what did that look mean?
She tilts her head.
He looked familiar for some reason, Four.
I can't imagine why, he replies, his voice suddenly cold. I don't make a habit of associating with the abnegation.
My mother laughs. She has a light laugh, half air and half sound. Few people do these days. I don't take it personally.
He seems to relax a little.
Well, I'll leave you to your reunion.
My mother and I watch him leave. The roar of the river fills my ears. Maybe Four was one of the erudite, which explains why he hates abnegation. Or maybe he believes the articles the erudite release about us, them, I remind myself. But it was kind of him to tell her that I'm doing well, when I know he doesn't believe it.
Is he always like that? She says.
Worse.
Have you made friends? She asks.
A few, I say. I look over my shoulder at Will and Christina and their families. When Christina catches my eye, she beckons to me, smiling. So my mother and I cross the pit floor. Before we can get to Will and Christina, though, a short, round woman with a black-and-white striped shirt touches my arm. I twitch, resisting the urge to smack her hand away.
"Excuse me," she says. "Do you know my son, Albert?"
"Albert," I repeat.
"Oh, you mean Al. Yes, I know him."
"Do you know where we can find him?" she says, gesturing to a man behind her. He is tall and as thick as a boulder. Al's father, obviously.
"I'm sorry, I didn't see him this morning. Maybe you should look for him up there?"
I point at the glass ceiling above us.
"Oh, my," Al's mother says, fanning her face with her hand. "I would rather not attempt that climb again. I almost had a panic attack on the way down here. Why aren't there any railings along those paths? Are you all insane?"
I smile a little. A few weeks ago, I might have found that question offensive, but now I spend too much time with candor transfers to be surprised by tactlessness.
"Insane? No," I say. "Dauntless? Yes. If I see him, I'll tell him you're looking for him."
My mother, I see, wears the same smile I do. She isn't reacting the way some of the other transfers' parents are, her neck bent, looking around at the pit walls, at the pit ceiling, at the chasm. Of course she isn't curious. She's abnegation. Curiosity is foreign to her. I introduce my mother to Will and Christina, and Christina introduces me to her mother and her sister. But when Will introduces me to Kara, his older sister, she gives me the kind of look that would wither a plant and does not extend her hand for me to shake. She glares at my mother.
"I can't believe that you would associate with one of them, Will," she says.
My mother purses her lips, but of course doesn't say anything.
"Kara," says Will, frowning. "There's no need to be rude."
"Oh, certainly not. Do you know what she is?" She points at my mother. "She's a council member's wife, is what she is. She runs the volunteer agency that supposedly helps the factionless. You think I don't know that you're just hoarding goods to distribute to your own faction while we don't get fresh food for a month, huh? Food for the factionless, my eye.
I'm sorry, my mother says gently. I believe you are mistaken.
Mistaken, ha, Kara snaps. I'm sure you're exactly what you seem. A faction of happy-go-lucky do-gooders without a selfish bone in their bodies. Right. Don't speak to my mother that way, I say, my face hot. I clench my hands into fists. Don't say another word to her, or I swear I will break your nose.
Back off, Triss, Will says. You're not going to punch my sister.
Oh, I say, raising both eyebrows. You think so?
No, you're not. My mother touches my shoulder. Come on, Beatrice. We wouldn't want to bother your friend's sister.
She sounds gentle, but her hand squeezes my arm so hard I almost cry out from the pain as she drags me away. She walks with me fast toward the dining hall. Just before she reaches it, though, she takes a sharp left turn and walks down one of the dark hallways I haven't explored yet.
Mom, I say. Mom, how do you know where you're going?
She stops next to a locked door and stands on her tiptoes, peering at the base of the blue lamp hanging from the ceiling. A few seconds later, she nods and turns to me again.
I said no questions about me, and I meant it. How are you really doing, Beatrice? How have the fights been? How are you ranked?
Ranked? I say. You know that I've been fighting? You know that I'm ranked?
It isn't top-secret information, how the Dauntless initiation process works. I don't know how easy it is to find out what another faction does during initiation, but I suspect it's not that easy. Slowly, I say, I'm close to the bottom, Mom.
Good, she nods. No one looks too closely at the bottom. Now, this is very important, Beatrice. What were your aptitude test results?
Tori's warning pulses in my head.
Don't tell anyone.
I should tell her that my result was abnegation, because that's what Tori recorded in the system. I look into my mother's eyes, which are pale green and framed by a dark smudge of eyelashes. She has lines around her mouth, but other than that, she doesn't look her age. Those lines get deeper when she hums. She used to hum as she washed the dishes. This is my mother. I can trust her.
They were inconclusive, I say softly. I thought as much, she sighs.
Many children who are raised abnegation receive that kind of result. We don't know why, but you have to be very careful during the next stage of initiation, Beatrice. Stay in the middle of the pack, no matter what you do. Don't draw attention to yourself. Do you understand?
Mom, what's going on?
I don't care what faction you chose, she says, touching her hands to my cheeks. I am your mother, and I want to keep you safe.
If this is because I'm a... I start to say, but she presses her hand to my mouth.
Don't say that word, she hisses. Ever.
So Tori was right. Divergent is a dangerous thing to be. I just don't know why, or even what it really means still.
Why?
She shakes her head.
I can't say.
She looks over her shoulder, where the light from the pit floor is barely visible. I hear shouts and conversations, laughter and shuffling footsteps. The smell from the dining hall floats over my nose, sweet and yeasty, baking bread. When she turns toward me, her jaw is set.
There's something I want you to do, she says. I can't go visit your brother, but you can, when initiation is over. So I want you to go find him and tell him to research the simulation serum. Okay? Can you do that for me?
Not unless you explain some of this to me, Mom. I cross my arms.
You want me to go hang out at the erudite compound for the day? You had better give me a reason.
I can't. I'm sorry. She kisses my cheek and brushes a lock of hair that fell from my bun behind my ear.
I should leave. It will make you look better if you and I don't seem attached to each other.
I don't care how I look to them. I say. You should, she says. I suspect they are already monitoring you. She walks away, and I am too stunned to follow her. At the end of the hallway, she turns and says, Have a piece of cake for me, all right? The chocolate. It's delicious. She smiles a strange, twisted smile and adds, I love you, you know. And then she's gone. I stand alone in the blue light, coming from the lamp above me, and I understand. She has been to the compound before. She remembered this hallway. She knows about the initiation process. My mother was dauntless. Chapter 16. That afternoon, I go back to the dormitory while everyone else spends time with their families, and find Al sitting on his bed staring at the space on the wall where the chalkboard usually is. Four took it down yesterday so he could calculate our Stage 1 rankings. There you are, I say. Your parents were looking for you. Did they find you? He shakes his head. I sit down next to him on the bed. My leg is barely half the width of his, even now that it's more muscular than it was. He wears black shorts. His knee is purple-blue with a bruise and crossed with a scar. You didn't want to see them? I say. Didn't want them to ask how I was doing, he says. I'd have to tell them. They would know if I was lying. Well, I struggle to come up with something to say. What's wrong with how you're doing? Al laughs harshly. I've lost every fight since the one with Will. I'm not doing well. By choice, though. Couldn't you tell them that, too? He shakes his head. Dad always wanted me to come here. I mean, they said they wanted me to stay in Candor, but that's only because it's what they're supposed to say. They've always admired the Dauntless, both of them. They wouldn't understand if I tried to explain it to them. Oh. I tap my fingers against my knee. Then I look at him. Is that why you chose Dauntless? Because of your parents? Al shakes his head. No. I guess it was because I think it's important to protect people, to stand up for people, like you did for me. He smiles at me. That's what the Dauntless are supposed to do, right? That's what courage is, not hurting people for no reason. I remember what Four told me, that teamwork used to be a Dauntless priority. What were the Dauntless like when it was? What would I have learned if I had been here when my mother was Dauntless? Maybe I wouldn't have broken Molly's nose, or threatened Will's sister. I feel a pang of guilt. Maybe it will be better once initiation is over. Too bad I might come in last, Al says. I guess we'll see tonight. We sit side by side for a while. It's better to be here, in silence, than in the pit, watching everyone laugh with their families. My father used to say that sometimes the best way to help someone is just to be near them. I feel good when I do something I know he would be proud of, like it makes up for all the things I've done that he wouldn't be proud of. I feel braver when I'm around you, you know, he says. Like I could actually fit in here, the same way you do. I'm about to respond when he slides his arm across my shoulders. Suddenly I freeze, my cheeks hot. I didn't want to be right about Al's feelings for me, but I was. I do not lean into him. Instead, I sit forward so his arm falls away. Then I squeeze my hands together in my lap. Triss, I... he says. His voice sounds strained. I glance at him. His face is as red as mine feels, but he's not crying. He just looks embarrassed. Sorry, he says. I wasn't trying to... sorry. I wish I could tell him not to take it personally. I could tell him that my parents rarely held hands even in our own home, so I have trained myself to pull away from all gestures of affection, because they raised me to take them seriously. Maybe if I told him that, there wouldn't be a layer of hurt beneath his flush of embarrassment. But of course, it is personal. He is my friend, and that is all. What is more personal than that? I breathe in, and when I breathe out, I make myself smile.
Sorry about what? I ask, trying to sound casual. I brush off my jeans, though there isn't anything on them, and stand up.
I should go, I say.
He nods and doesn't look at me.
You're going to be okay? I say.
I mean,
because of your parents?
Not because...
I let my voice trail off.
I don't know what I would say if I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
He nods again a little too vigorously.
I'll see you later, Tris.
I try not to walk out of the room too fast. When the dormitory door closes behind me, I touch a hand to my forehead and grin a little. Awkwardness aside, it is nice to be liked. Discussing our family visits would be too painful, so our final rankings for Stage 1 are all anyone can talk about that night. Every time someone near me brings it up, I stare at some point across the room and ignore them. My rank can't be as bad as it used to be, especially after I beat Molly, but it might not be good enough to get me in the top 10 at the end of initiation, especially when the Dauntlessborn initiates are factored in. At dinner I sit with Christina, Will, and Al at a table in the corner. We are uncomfortably close to Peter, Drew, and Molly, who are at the next table over. When conversation at our table reaches a lull, I hear every word they say. They are speculating about the ranks. What a surprise.
You aren't allowed to have pets, Christina demands, smacking the table with her palm.
Why not?
Because they're illogical, Will says matter-of-factly. What is the point in providing food and shelter for an animal that just soils your furniture, makes your home smell bad, and ultimately dies?
Al and I meet eyes, like we usually do when Will and Christina start to fight. But this time, the second our eyes meet, we both look away. I hope this awkwardness between us doesn't last long. I want my friend back.
The point is...
Christina's voice trails off, and she tilts her head.
Well, they're fun to have. I had a bulldog named Chunker. One time, we left a whole roasted chicken on the counter to cool, and while my mother went to the bathroom, he pulled it down off the counter and ate it. Bones and skin and all. We laughed so hard.
Yes, that certainly changes my mind. Of course I want to live with an animal that eats all my food and destroys my kitchen.
Will shakes his head. Why don't you just get a dog after initiation if you're feeling that nostalgic?
Because... Christina's smile falls, and she pokes at her potato with her fork. Dogs are sort of ruined for me.
After, you know, after the aptitude test?
We exchange looks. We all know that we aren't supposed to talk about the test, not even now that we have chosen. But for them, that rule must not be as serious as it is for me. My heart jumps unsteadily in my chest. For me, that rule is protection. It keeps me from having to lie to my friends about my results. Every time I think the word divergent, I hear Tori's warning, and now my mother's warning, too. Don't tell anyone. Dangerous.
You mean killing the dog, right? Asks Will.
I almost forgot. Those with an aptitude for Dauntless picked up the knife in the simulation and stabbed the dog when it attacked. No wonder Christina doesn't want a pet dog anymore. I tug my sleeves over my wrists and twist my fingers together.
Yeah, she says.
I mean, you guys all had to do that too, right?
She looks first at Al and then at me. Her dark eyes narrow and she says,
You didn't.
Hmm?
You're hiding something, she says. You're fidgeting.
What?
In candor, says Al, nudging me with his shoulder. There. That feels normal.
We learn to read body language so we know when someone is lying or keeping something from us.
Oh. I scratch the back of my neck. Well,
see? There it is again, she says, pointing at my hand.
I feel like I'm swallowing my heartbeat. How can I lie about my results if they can tell when I'm lying? I'll have to control my body language.
I drop my hand and clasp my hands in my lap.
Is that what an honest person does? I don't have to lie about the dog, at least.
No, I didn't kill the dog.
How did you get Dauntless without using the knife? Says Will, narrowing his eyes at me.
I look him in the eye and say evenly, I didn't. I got abnegation. It is half true. Tori reported my result as abnegation, so that is what is in the system. Anyone who has access to the scores would be able to see it. I keep my eyes on his for a few seconds. Shifting them away might be suspicious. Then I shrug and stab a piece of meat with my fork. I hope they believe me. They have to believe me. But you chose Dauntless anyway? Christina says. Why? I told you, I say, smirking. It was the food. She laughs. Did you guys know that Triss had never seen a hamburger before she came here? She launches into the story of our first day, and my body relaxes. But I still feel heavy. I should not lie to my friends. It creates barriers between us, and we already have more than I want. Christina taking the flag, me rejecting Al. After dinner, we go back to the dormitory, and it's hard for me not to sprint, knowing that the rankings will be up when I get there. I want to get it over with. At the door to the dormitory, Drew shoves me into the wall to get past me. My shoulder scrapes on the stone, but I keep walking. I'm too short to see over the crowd of initiates standing near the back of the room, but when I find a space between heads to look through, I see that the blackboard is on the ground, leaning against Four's legs, facing away from us. He stands with a piece of chalk in one hand. For those of you who just came in, I'm explaining how the ranks are determined, he says. After the first round of fights, we ranked you according to your skill level. The number of points you earn depend on your skill level and the skill level of the person you beat. You earn more points for improving and more points for beating someone of a high skill level. I don't reward preying on the weak. That is cowardice. I think his eyes linger on Peter at that last line, but they move on quickly enough that I'm not sure. If you have a high rank, you lose points for losing to a low-ranked opponent. Molly lets out an unpleasant noise, like a snort or a grumble. Stage 2 of training is weighted more heavily than Stage 1, because it is more closely tied to overcoming cowardice, he says. That said, it is extremely difficult to rank high at the end of initiation if you rank low in Stage 1. I shift from one foot to the other, trying to get a good look at him. When I finally do, I look away. His eyes are already on me, probably drawn by my nervous movement. We will announce the cuts tomorrow, Four says. The fact that you are transfers and the Dauntless-born initiates are not will not be taken into consideration. Four of you could be factionless and none of them, or four of them could be factionless and none of you, or any combination thereof. That said, here are your ranks. He hangs the board on the hook and steps back so we can see the rankings. 1. Edward. 2. Peter. 3. Will. 4. Christina. 5. Molly. 6. Triss. 6th? I can't be 6th. Beating Molly must have boosted my rank more than I thought it would, and losing to me seems to have lowered hers. I skip to the bottom of the list. 7. Drew. 8. Al. 9. Myra. Al isn't dead last, but unless the Dauntless-born initiates completely failed their version of Stage 1 of initiation, he is factionless. I glance at Christina. She tilts her head and frowns at the board. She isn't the only one. The quiet in the room is uneasy, like it is rocking back and forth on a ledge. Then it falls. What? Demands Molly. She points at Christina. I beat her. I beat her in minutes, and she ranked above me. Yeah, says Christina, crossing her arms. She wears a smug smile. And? If you intend to secure yourself a high rank, I suggest you don't make a habit of losing to low-ranked opponents, says Four, his voice cutting through the mutters and grumbles of the other initiates. He pockets the chalk and walks past me without glancing in my direction. The words sting a little, reminding me that I'm the low-ranked opponent he's referring to. Apparently they remind Molly, too. You, she says, focusing her narrowed eyes on me. You are going to pay for this. I expect her to lunge at me, or hit me. But she just turns on her heel and stalks out of the dormitory, and that is worse. If she had exploded, her anger would have been spent quickly, after a punch or two. Leaving means she wants to plan something. Leaving means I have to be on my guard. Peter didn't say anything when the rankings went up, which, given his tendency to complain about anything that doesn't go his way, is surprising. He just walks to his bunk and sits down, untying his shoelaces. That makes me feel even more uneasy. He can't possibly be satisfied with second place. Not Peter. Will and Christina slap hands, and then Will claps me on the back with a hand bigger than my shoulder blade. "Look at you, number six," he says, grinning. "Still might not have been good enough," I remind him. "It will be. Don't worry," he says. "We should celebrate." "Well, let's go then," says Christina, grabbing my arm with one hand and Al's arm with the other. "Come on, Al. You don't know how the Dauntless Borns did. You don't know anything for sure."
"I'm just going to go to bed," he mumbles, pulling his arm free.
In the hallway, it is easy to forget about Al and Molly's revenge and Peter's suspicious calm, and easy to pretend that what separates us as friends does not exist. But lingering at the back of my mind is the fact that Christina and Will are my competitors. If I want to fight my way to the top 10, I will have to beat them first. I just hope I don't have to betray them in the process. That night, I have trouble falling asleep. The dormitory used to seem loud to me, with all the breathing, but now it is too quiet. When it's quiet, I think about my family. Thank God the Dauntless compound is usually loud. If my mother was dauntless, why did she choose abnegation? Did she love its peace, its routine, its goodness, all the things I miss when I let myself think about it? I wonder if someone here knew her when she was young and could tell me what she was like then. Even if they did, they probably wouldn't want to discuss her. Faction transfers are not really supposed to discuss their old factions once they become members. It's supposed to make it easier for them to change their allegiance from family to faction, to embrace the principle, faction before blood. I bury my face in the pillow. She asked me to tell Caleb to research the simulation serum. Why? Does it have something to do with me being divergent? With me being in danger? Or is it something else? I sigh. I have 1,000 questions, and she left before I could ask any of them. Now they swirl in my head, and I doubt I'll be able to sleep until I can answer them. I hear a scuffle across the room, and lift my head from the pillow. My eyes aren't adjusted to the dark, so I stare into pure black, like the backs of my eyelids. I hear shuffling and the squeak of a shoe, a heavy thud, and then a wail that curdles my blood and makes my hair stand on end. I throw the blankets back and stand on the stone floor with bare feet. I still can't see well enough to find the source of the scream, but I see a dark lump on the floor, a few bunks down. Another scream pierces my ears.
"Turn on the lights!"
someone shouts. I walk toward the sound, slowly, so I don't trip over anything. I feel like I'm in a trance. I don't want to see where the screaming is coming from. A scream like that can only mean blood and bone and pain. That scream that comes from the pit of the stomach and extends to every inch of the body. The lights come on. Edward lies on the floor next to his bed, clutching at his face. Surrounding his head is a halo of blood, and jutting between his clawing fingers is a silver knife handle. My heart thumping in my ears, I recognize it as a butter knife from the dining hall. The blade is stuck in Edward's eye. Myra, who stands at Edward's feet, screams. Someone else screams too, and someone yells for help, and Edward is still on the floor, writhing and wailing. I crouch by his head, my knees pressing to the pool of blood, and put my hands on his shoulders. "Lie still," I say. I feel calm, though I can't hear anything, like my head is submerged in water. Edward thrashes again, and I say it louder, sterner. "I said, lie still. Breathe."
"My eye!"
he screams. I smell something foul. Someone vomited.
"Take it out!" he yells. Get it out! Get it out of me! Get it out!
I shake my head and then realize that he can't see me. A laugh bubbles in my stomach, hysterical. I have to suppress hysteria if I'm going to help him. I have to forget myself. No, I say. You have to let the doctor take it out. Hear me? Let the doctor take it out. And breathe.
It hurts, he sobs.
I know it does. Instead of my voice, I hear my mother's voice. I see her crouching before me on the sidewalk in front of our house, brushing tears from my face after I scraped my knee. I was 5 at the time. It will be all right. I try to sound firm, like I'm not idly reassuring him, but I am. I don't know if it will be all right. I suspect that it won't. When the nurse arrives, she tells me to step back, and I do. My hands and knees are soaked with blood. When I look around, I see that only 2 faces are missing. Drew and Peter. After they take Edward away, I carry a change of clothes into the bathroom and wash my hands. Christina comes with me and stands by the door, but she doesn't say anything, and I'm glad. There isn't much to say. I scrub at the lines in my palms and run 1 fingernail under my other fingernails to get the blood out. I change into the pants I brought and throw the soiled ones in the trash. I get as many paper towels as I can hold. Someone needs to clean up the mess in the dormitory, and since I doubt I'll ever be able to sleep again, it might as well be me. As I reach for the door handle, Christina says, "You know who did that, right?"
"Yeah."
"Should we tell someone?" "You really think the Dauntless will do anything?" I say. "After they hung you over the chasm? After they made us beat each other unconscious?" She doesn't say anything. For a half hour after that, I kneel alone on the floor in the dormitory and scrub at Edward's blood. Christina throws away the dirty paper towels and gets me new ones. Myra's gone. She probably followed Edward to the hospital. No one sleeps much that night.
"This is going to sound weird," Will says, "but I wish we didn't have a day off today."
I nod. I know what he means. Having something to do would distract me, and I could use a distraction right now. I have not spent much time alone with Will, but Christina and Al are taking naps in the dormitory, and neither of us wanted to be in that room longer than we had to. Will didn't tell me that. I just know. I slide 1 fingernail under another. I washed my hands thoroughly after cleaning up Edward's blood, but I still feel like it's on my hands. Will and I walk with no sense of purpose. There is nowhere to go.
"We could visit him," suggests Will.
"But what would we say?
I didn't know you that well, but I'm sorry you got stabbed in the eye."
It isn't funny. I know that as soon as he says it, but a laugh rises in my throat anyway, and I let it out because it's harder to keep it in. Will stares at me for a second, and then he laughs too. Sometimes crying or laughing are the only options left, and laughing feels better right now.
"Sorry," I say. "It's just so ridiculous." I don't want to cry for Edward, at least not in the deep personal way that you cry for a friend or loved one. I want to cry because something terrible happened, and I saw it, and I could not see a way to mend it.
No one who would want to punish Peter has the authority to, and no one who has the authority to punish him would want to. The Dauntless have rules against attacking someone like that, but with people like Eric in charge, I suspect those rules go unenforced. I say more seriously,
"The most ridiculous part is, in any other faction, it would be brave of us to tell someone what happened. But here, in Dauntless, bravery won't do us any good."
"Have you ever read the Faction Manifestos?" says Will. The Faction Manifestos were written after the factions formed. We learned about them in school, but I never read them.
"You have?"
I frown at him. Then I remember that Will once memorized a map of the city for fun, and I say,
"Oh, of course you have. Never mind."
One of the lines I remember from the Dauntless Manifesto is, "We believe in ordinary acts of bravery, in the courage that drives one person to stand up for another."
Will sighs. He doesn't need to say anything else. I know what he means.
Maybe Dauntless was formed with good intentions, with the right ideals and the right goals, but it has strayed far from them. And the same is true of Erudite, I realize. A long time ago, Erudite pursued knowledge and ingenuity for the sake of doing good. Now they pursue knowledge and ingenuity with greedy hearts. I wonder if the other factions suffer from the same problem. I've not thought about it before. Despite the depravity I see in Dauntless, though, I could not leave it. It isn't only because the thought of living factionless, in complete isolation, sounds like a fate worse than death. It is because, in the brief moments that I have loved it here, I saw a faction worth saving. Maybe we can become brave and honorable again. Let's go to the cafeteria, Will says, and eat cake. Okay, I smile. As we walk toward the pit, I repeat the line Will quoted to myself so I don't forget it. I believe in ordinary acts of bravery, in the courage that drives one person to stand up for another. It is a beautiful thought. Later, when I return to the dormitory, Edward's bunk is stripped clean, and his drawers are open, empty. Across the room, Myra's bunk looks the same way. When I ask Christina where they went, she says, "They quit." Even Myra? She said she didn't want to be here without him. She was going to get cut anyway. She shrugs like she can't think of anything else to do. If that's true, I know how she feels. At least they didn't cut Al. Al was supposed to get cut, but Edward's departure saved him. The Dauntless decided to spare him until the next stage. Who else got cut? I say. Christina shrugs again. Two of the Dauntless born. I don't remember their names. I nod and look at the blackboard. Someone drew a line through Edward and Myra's names, and changed the numbers next to everyone else's names. Now Peter is first. Will is second. I am fifth. We started stage one with 9 initiates. Now we have 7. Chapter 17. It's noon, lunchtime. I sit in a hallway I don't recognize. I walked here because I needed to get away from the dormitory. Maybe if I bring my bedding here, I will never have to go to the dormitory again. It may be my imagination, but it still smells like blood in there, even though I scrubbed the floor until my hands were sore, and someone poured bleach on it this morning. I pinched the bridge of my nose. Scrubbing the floor when no one else wanted to was something that my mother would have done. If I can't be with her, the least I can do is act like her sometimes. I hear people approaching, their footsteps echoing on the stone floor, and I look down at my shoes. I switched from gray sneakers to black sneakers a week ago, but the gray shoes are buried in one of my drawers. I can't bear to throw them away, even though I know it's foolish to be attached to sneakers, like they can bring me home. Triss. I look up. Uriah stops in front of me. He waves along the Dauntless-born initiates he walks with. They exchange looks, but keep moving. You okay? He says. I had a difficult night. Yeah, I heard about that guy Edward. Uriah looks down the hallway. The Dauntless-born initiates disappear around a corner. Then he grins a little. Want to get out of here? What? I ask. Where are you going? To a little initiation ritual, he says. Come on, we have to hurry. I briefly consider my options. I can sit here, or I can leave the Dauntless compound. I push myself to my feet and jog next to Uriah to catch up to the Dauntless-born initiates. The only initiates they usually let come are the ones with older siblings in Dauntless, he says. But they might not even notice. Just act like you belong. What exactly are we doing? Something dangerous, he says. A look I can only describe as dauntless mania enters his eyes. But rather than recoil from it, as I might have a few weeks ago, I catch it, like it's contagious. Excitement replaces the leaden feeling inside me. We slow when we reach the dauntless-born initiates. What's the stiff doing here? Asks a boy with a metal ring between his nostrils. She just saw that guy get stabbed in the eye, Gabe, says Uriah. Give her a break, okay? Gabe shrugs and turns away. No one says anything, though a few of them give me sidelong glances like they're sizing me up. The Dauntless-born initiates are like a pack of dogs. If I act the wrong way, they won't let me run with them. But for now, I am safe. We turn another corner, and a group of members stands at the end of the next hallway. There are too many of them to be all related to a Dauntless-born initiate, but I see some similarities among the faces.
Let's go, one of the members says.
He turns and plunges through a dark doorway. The other members follow him, and we follow them. I stay close behind Uriah as I pass into darkness, and my toe hits a step. I catch myself before falling forward and start to climb.
Back staircase, Uriah says, almost mumbling. Usually locked.
I nod, though he can't see me, and climb until all the steps are gone. By then, a door at the top of the staircase is open, letting in daylight. We emerge from the ground a few hundred yards from the glass building above the pit, close to the train tracks. I feel like I have done this 1,000 times before. I hear the train horn. I feel the vibrations in the ground. I see the light attached to the head car. I crack my knuckles and bounce once on my toes. We jog in a single pack next to the car, and in waves, members and initiates alike pile into the car. Uriah gets in before me, and people press behind me. I can't make any mistakes. I throw myself sideways, grabbing the handle on the side of the car, and hoist myself into the car. Uriah grabs my arm to steady me. The train picks up its speed. Uriah and I sit against one of the walls. I shout over the wind.
Where are we going?
Uriah shrugs.
Zeke never told me.
Zeke? My older brother, he says. He points across the room at a boy sitting in the doorway, with his legs dangling out of the car. He is slight and short, and looks nothing like Uriah, apart from his coloring.
You don't get to know. That ruins the surprise,
the girl on my left shouts. She extends her hand.
I'm Shauna.
I shake her hand, but I don't grip hard enough, and I let go too quickly. I doubt I will ever improve my handshake. It feels unnatural to grasp hands with strangers. I start to say.
I know who you are, she says. You're the stiff.
Four told me about you. I pray the heat in my cheeks is not visible.
Oh? What did he say?
She smirks at me.
He said you were a stiff. Why do you ask?
If my instructor is talking about me, I say as firmly as I can. I want to know what he's saying. I hope I tell a convincing lie.
He isn't coming, is he?
No. He never comes to this, she says. It's probably lost its appeal. Not much scares him, you know. He isn't coming. Something in me deflates like an untied balloon. I ignore it and nod. I do know that Four is not a coward, but I also know that at least one thing does scare him. Heights. Whatever we're doing, it must involve being high up for him to avoid it. She must not know that if she speaks of him with such reverence in her voice.
Do you know him well?
I ask. I am too curious. I always have been.
Everyone knows Four, she says.
We were initiates together. I was bad at fighting, so he taught me every night after everyone was asleep. She scratches the back of her neck, her expression suddenly serious.
Nice of him.
She gets up and stands behind the members sitting in the doorway. In a second, her serious expression is gone, but I still feel rattled by what she said, half confused by the idea of Four being nice, and half wanting to punch her for no apparent reason.
Here we go, shouts Shauna.
The train doesn't slow down, but she throws herself out of the car. The other members follow her, a stream of black-clothed, pierced people not much older than I am. I stand in the doorway next to Uriah. The train is going much faster than it has every other time I've jumped, but I can't lose my nerve now, in front of all these members. So I jump, hitting the ground hard and stumbling forward a few steps before I regain my balance. Uriah and I jog to catch up to the members, along with the other initiates, who barely look in my direction. I look around as I walk. The hub is behind us, black against the clouds, but the buildings around me are dark and silent. That means we must be north of the bridge, where the city is abandoned. We turn a corner and spread out as we walk down Michigan Avenue. South of the bridge, Michigan Avenue is a busy street, crawling with people, but here it is bare. As soon as I lift my eyes to scan the buildings, I know where we're going. The empty Hancock building. A black pillar with crisscross girders. The tallest building north of the bridge. But what are we going to do? Climb it? As we get closer, the members start to run, and Uriah and I sprint to catch them. Jostling one another with their elbows, they push through a set of doors at the building's base. The glass in one of them is broken, so it is just a frame. I step through it, instead of opening it, and follow the members through an eerie, dark entryway, crunching broken glass beneath my feet. I expect us to go up the stairs, but we stop at the elevator bank. Do the elevators work? I ask Uriah as quietly as I can.
Sure they do, says Zeke, rolling his eyes. You think I'm stupid enough not to come here early and turn on the emergency generator?
Yeah, says Uriah.
I kinda do.
Zeke glares at his brother, then puts him in a headlock and rubs his knuckles into Uriah's skull. Zeke may be smaller than Uriah, but he must be stronger,
or at least faster.
Uriah smacks him in the side, and he lets go. I grin at the sight of Uriah's disheveled hair, and the elevator doors open. We pile in, members in one and initiates in the other. A girl with a shaved head stomps on my toes on the way in and doesn't apologize. I grab my foot, wincing, and consider kicking her in the shins. Uriah stares at his reflection in the elevator doors and pats his hair down.
What floor? The girl with the shaved head says.
100, I say.
How would you know that?
Lynn, come on, says Uriah. Be nice.
We're in a 100-story abandoned building with some dauntless, I retort.
Why don't you know that?
She doesn't respond. She just jams her thumb into the right button. The elevator zooms upward so fast my stomach sinks and my ears pop. I grab a railing at the side of the elevator, watching the numbers climb. We pass 20 and 30, and Uriah's hair is finally smooth. 50, 60, and my toes are done throbbing. 98, 99, and the elevator comes to a stop at 100.
I'm glad we didn't take the stairs.
I wonder how we'll get to the roof from... Uriah's voice trails off. A strong wind hits me, pushing my hair across my face. There is a gaping hole in the ceiling of the 100th floor. Zeke props an aluminum ladder against its edge and starts to climb. The ladder creaks and sways beneath his feet, but he keeps climbing, whistling as he does. When he reaches the roof, he turns around and holds the top of the ladder for the next person. Part of me wonders if this is a suicide mission, disguised as a game. It isn't the first time I've wondered that since the choosing ceremony. I climb the ladder after Uriah. It reminds me of climbing the rungs on the Ferris wheel, with four close at my heels. I remember his fingers on my hip again, how they kept me from falling, and I almost miss a step on the ladder. Stupid. Biting my lip, I make it to the top and stand on the roof of the Hancock building. The wind is so powerful, I hear and feel nothing else. I have to lean against Uriah to keep from falling over. At first, all I see is the marsh, wide and brown, and everywhere, touching the horizon, devoid of life. In the other direction is the city, and in many ways, it is the same, lifeless and with limits I do not know. Uriah points to something. Attached to one of the poles on top of the tower is a steel cable, as thick as my wrist. On the ground is a pile of black slings, made of tough fabric, large enough to hold a human being. Zeke grabs one and attaches it to a pulley that hangs from the steel cable. I follow the cable down, over the cluster of buildings, and along Lakeshore Drive. I don't know where it ends. One thing is clear, though. If I go through with this, I'll find out. We're going to slide down a steel cable in a black sling from 1,000 feet up. Oh my God, says Uriah.
All I can do is nod.
Shauna is the first person to get in the sling. She wriggles forward on her stomach,